sometimes it gives you so much data, you have to figure out, you have to decide, well, what's the most important thing? And I think, that's where, the clinician and the diagnostician, they have to work very closely together because, again, you may see, a virus or bacteria in that flock. And the question is that what's causing the disease that we're seeing? Or is it just a random finding unrelated to what we're looking at? And it still requires, a really highly skilled clinician and diagnostician in the laboratory to help answer those questions. And some cases, further work is required to tease that out.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with nonlinear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Poultry Star is a unique feed ingredient that includes a prebiotic and probiotic, and it's designed specifically for poultry. Improve gut health with Poultry Star. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/poultrystar. Natural Biologics is looking deeper to find the natural solutions to your poultry health challenges. Zoetis Hatchery Health Team helps you raise field-ready birds with a strong immune foundation. Learn more at zoetis.com. Bin Sentry, the world's most trusted feed management platform.
All right, welcome to the Poultry Podcast Show. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Bobeck, and today I'm here with Dr. David Suarez. Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
So today we're going to talk about next generation sequencing and some things that are going on in the poultry health world right now and how those technologies can be used. But first, can you tell me a little bit of how you got to where you are today and how you became fascinated with next-gen sequencing?
Sure. I'll try to summarize my lifelong yeah. career. So first, I'm a veterinarian. I actually practiced in small animal practice for 3 years before I decided to go back and get my PhD. I worked in cattle virology at Iowa State University, and when I graduated there, I was fortunate to come to the Southeast Poultry Research Laboratory, now the U.S. National Poultry Research Laboratory or Center here in Athens, Georgia. And I've been working on poultry diseases ever since then. Most of my time, we've been looking at diagnostics have been a large part of what I've been looking at over the years, and probably some of the most impactful research I've done is with real-time RT-PCR for several different diseases that are important for the control in the U.S., and they become used worldwide. Now, in the last 5 years in particular, I've really started moving more towards looking at next generation sequencing, because when I looked at the technology that I thought was going to be impactful, I felt like that was an area that had a lot of potential. And I also like to, of course, being at a research lab, I also need to think about things that I can, provide additional value to. And there's some technologies that, comes basically, it's a black box and you put your sample in, you get your results out. But NGS is kind of the Wild West right now. So there's lots of different platforms, there's lots of different ways of doing it. And so there's lots of different opportunities to make improvements that will help out everyone, because it is a relatively new technology and it's being used in different ways. I think there's a lot of potential for this technology in the future.
A worldwide leader in animal nutrition, Adiseo's portfolio of products includes methionine, the full range of vitamins, enzymes, organic selenium, probiotics, mycotoxin management strategies, and palatability products. With such a diverse offering, Adiseo supports its customers with a broad range of expertise, tools, and services to help them maintain a competitive advantage. Adiseo, fueling predictable profits. To learn more, visit Adiseo at www.adiseo.com.
So for those folks who might not be familiar, can you just kind of give a 30,000-foot view of what next-generation sequencing is and maybe how we got here? Like, why is it different than other traditional diagnostic methods?
So next generation sequencing is really, it's a group of different types of technologies. And so it's just a broad term for what we say is improved generation, next generation of sequencing, that really has just lowered the cost of sequencing to just a fraction of what it was 10 or 15 years ago. So now we can get a lot more sequence at a much lower cost that has allowed us to do different things that we couldn't do previously. And we also have developed methods that, again, using that large amount of data, that we can look at problems in a different way. And we can look at it, you know, by using a random amplification approach so we can look at a bunch of different pathogens at the same time. So when we compare it back, we think about Sanger sequencing, which is really, you know, that we developed the first human genome using Sanger sequencing. But again, and we still use Sanger sequencing, which is the older technology. But again, next-gen sequencing is just, it can be a lot faster, it's a lot simpler, and of course, much less cost than what we've seen previously. Now, when we talk about the different sequencing platforms, I'll just kind of break it down into, we can either have short read sequencing, which platforms like Illumina have, or the long read sequencing, meaning just, you know, the short read is 50 to 300 base pairs of sequence per read. And then we have the long read sequencing, which can be thousands of base pairs in a single read. And then PacBio and MinION are two of the technologies that can do the long read sequencing. Now, we typically look at more of the short read sequencing in part because the viruses that we work with have shorter genomes. So we're not looking at whole genomes. We're not looking at bacterial genomes. We're looking at small viral genomes, you know, 10, 15 kilobases in size. So the short read sequencing does for us a better, more comprehensive job. Now, there's difficulties in working with next-gen sequencing in part because you get so much sequence data, you have to be able to manage all of that data. So you have to have, you know, certainly good software programs to help you manage that data. You have to have, in some cases, bioinformaticists to help you manage that data. And it certainly makes it a little bit more difficult to get into the field than, say, Sanger sequencing, which is a more mature technology. And again, as things are improving, the software is improving, so it is becoming easier. The bar to getting in, starting to do next-gen sequencing is lower than it was 5 years ago, and it will continue to get easier to do that work as well. So again, as we mentioned, you know, the cost per base pair is low, but a single sequencing run is oftentimes several thousand dollars because of the library preparation that's required, the requirement for the actual sequencing, the cartridge that you're using for the different kits that you need, and then we're talking about the time needed for the bioanalysis afterwards. Again, we oftentimes will try to reduce those costs by barcoding samples where we're putting, you know, unique codes on the sequences and running a bunch of samples at one time. A lot of times we'll barcode up to 96 samples, which greatly reduces the cost per sample that we have for the running. But it still takes time for the library preparation and the bioinformatics to pull all that together. And finally, you know, the lower cost of samples, you know, is making it more available, again, for clinicians and diagnosticians to use that information to think about, well, can we look at these samples to get a unique answer that we hadn't thought of looking at before?
Yeah, the cost is huge, right? Like having the cost go down means more people can use the technology and you can learn more about the technology itself.
That's right. It does. And that has made a big difference. And again, the cost of the equipment has gone down and the cost of the cartridges have come down. And again, the bioinformatics has improved. But we're also seeing that these new sequencers that are coming out actually are increasing the amount of data. So we're literally getting gigabytes of sequence data coming back to us that we have to deal with. And the newer machines, again, are up into the hundreds of gigabytes of data.
Yeah.
And so that is not something that you're going to run on your desktop computer and be able to analyze all that data.
No, that seems like a fire on your computer's hard drive. So what are the huge advantages? I mean, you're getting a ton of data back. Does it make it easier to identify pathogens? Is it just the resolution? What's so good about it?
Right. So, well, the thing that I really like about next-gen sequencing and then the way we are using it a lot is we're using random amplification, which means that we have primers that basically will amplify everything in the sample. And so the idea is we can theoretically pick out any pathogen in that clinical sample that's there. So we don't have to have any prior understanding or a prediction of what might be in that sample to test for it. We can actually go in and pick out, you know, pathogens that we thought might be there, but we can also pick up pathogens that we had no idea were in the samples. And that can really be a game changer because it can change your entire approach of how you're managing that flock. So, you know, that's the primary benefit is that it has that ability. But we also have seen that just being able to do whole genome sequences now with this technology using a targeted approach where we're actually just using PCR to do that initial amplification and then using these platforms to sequence it has made it much easier to sequence whole genomes. So we can get a 15,000 base pair virus like Newcastle disease. We can pull that out in a single run. Avian metapneumovirus, we can pull that out in a single run. And that makes it much easier and able to analyze that data. For some reasons, we need that depth. We need the full genome to really answer the questions that we need to have. And so that's the difference. We can do random amplification. We can do targeted amplification. And it just depends on what your goal is. Now, we also have to think about, you know, are you targeting a DNA pathogen or an RNA pathogen? Because that does make a difference. Because, you know, if you're dealing with DNA, if you're doing particularly a random amplification approach for RNA or DNA, you're going to get a lot of host DNA or sequence back out. And that's really, how do you manage that? For us, because I primarily work on RNA viruses, we primarily do an RNA amplification, and we have to worry about ribosomal RNA. So a lot of cases, it's, you know, 70 to 90% of the sequence we get back out, if we don't do any pre-treatment, we're getting host ribosomal RNA sequence. And that's useless. That's not helpful data for us. It doesn't help us answer the question. We know what the RNA sequence is, the ribosomal RNA sequence is for a chicken. We don't need to see it 1,000 times.
It's the volume.
So one of the things that our laboratory has been working on is how do we get rid of that non-target RNA so that we're getting more of what we're interested in and less of what we're not. And that's really what my lab has been doing a lot. So we have a method that we can go in and selectively remove all that ribosomal RNA sequence, both bacterial as well as host. So that leaves just that much. The rest of the sequence is more of what we want, which is looking for pathogens, looking for viruses, in some cases looking for bacteria, because we can actually look at the ribosomal sequence for the bacteria and be able to at least say what species it is. You know, if we have E. coli or foul cholera or something else, we can look at that just by the ribosomal RNA sequence and can tell what bacteria it is. We can actually even pick up some DNA viruses because, of course, DNA viruses have to have a messenger RNA to express their proteins. And we can pick up that messenger RNA. So some cases we might pick up a fowlpox or a Marex out of these clinical samples, not because we're targeting the DNA, but we're actually looking at the messenger RNA that's being produced in those cells. So it provides us a lot of ability to find and identify pathogens that we didn't know were in there, and to provide full genome sequences for pathogens that we suspected for being in there, which can help us particularly with our molecular epidemiology to have that full genome sequence, particularly when viruses are very similar to one another. It helps to be able to have that full genome sequence.
Yeah. Gosh, that would be just an incredible amount of information. And then you have to decide, what do I do with it? So that, yeah, I understand why you make those pipelines to make your life easier. So do you have any practical examples of where you've solved maybe mysteries or anything in the poultry production with your technology pipeline?
Yes, I've got a couple of examples that we published on. So the first one I'll talk about is we had a project a few years ago where we were getting samples from Mexico, and we were getting the samples on FDA carts because it's very difficult to give live virus samples out of Mexico, but they allow FDA carts to be sent out. And so we were looking at flocks with clinical disease, and we were testing them, and we found some things that we expected to see, things like infectious bronchitis. But some of the samples we found avian metapneumovirus type A, subtype A. So initially that was a big surprise to me. I didn't realize that avian metapneumovirus A was in Mexico. And I went back and did the research, and it was published in the literature a couple years before that somebody had found that virus in Mexico. So that confirmed it. But we were able to get five full genome sequences of that virus that were circulating in Mexico. And again, highlighted to, you know, the people that we were working with, well, they have a pathogen that they weren't expecting to see, but it appears to be relatively widespread in the flocks and the samples that we were testing. Now, how that played direct benefit for the U.S. poultry industry is because, of course, 2 years later, we had our own first introduction of avian metapneumovirus type A that entered into the U.S. And so the work that we had done in Mexico, we had sequenced those viruses. We also had modified the real-time PCR test that we had available to us so that they were more specific towards those Mexican strains. And when we had the outbreak in the U.S., we already had a test for the type A virus that was already basically ready to go, that people could use, that we had already done some validation with. Now, the virus in Mexico and what was in the U.S., they were very similar. They weren't exactly the same thing. So I don't want to imply that we got the virus from Mexico. We don't know where the virus came from. But it did show that it was similar. And again, having that information and being kind of prepared allowed us to have a better response than we would have otherwise. We didn't mention that the research unit that I work with, it's the Exotic and Emerging Avian Viral Disease Research Unit. And so that's one of the things that we have to keep an eye on. We're looking for what's going on in the rest of the world, what things might impact U.S. poultry. Can we prepare ourselves better, whether that's better diagnostics or maybe potentially better vaccines? That's a big part of our research goal or efforts in our laboratory. Now, a second example, again, I'll talk about the same outbreak that we, or not the same outbreak, the same samples or the same group of samples of that we were able to find a lot of infectious bronchitis virus. And again, infectious bronchitis, it's a coronavirus. It's about 25,000 base pairs in length. So one thing we were able to show in those samples is we were able to get a lot of full genome sequences. So we saw genomes that we expected to see that had been reported from Mexico, but we also saw a couple of genotypes that hadn't been reported in Mexico again. And that helps the producer understand that because the different types of genotypes means you may need a different kind of vaccine. Because some vaccines protect some genotypes well, but don't protect others. And understanding what's circulating helps you use the type of vaccine that's needed to get the best protection. Now, having full genome sequence, was it necessary to have the full genome sequence? Probably not. But it's nice to have that depth of coverage. We can look at specific genes and be able to predict some of that. But again, having that full genome sequence that we put into GeneBank that everybody can have access to, I think really helps out the entire poultry community.
Gosh, yeah. For sure.
The last example that I'll just pull out is that we also see viruses that we don't understand what role they might play in disease in poultry. And one in particular, Sisenovirus, it's an enteric virus, and it's a commonly, and we found it common in the samples that we were looking at, both in the U.S. and in Mexico. And it's been associated with some, enteric disease, maybe some runting, stunting type diseases. But we really don't know, and we weren't able to isolate the virus, well, in part because the samples we had were coming on FDA cards, which is inactivated samples. So that always leaves that question. We can't fulfill Koch's postulates because we can't test to see if these viruses are actually causing the disease in the laboratory that we see in the field. But again, understanding that association that we might have a pathogen that may cause disease and under certain circumstances or may cause disease when combined with other viruses or bacteria, I think is very important. And it's really difficult to tease that information out. I think as we get more and more data, we have seen more and more unique viruses, not necessarily unique. No one has discovered them before, but unique in that they were found in those species, and we don't understand if they were contributing to clinical disease or not. Again, because we can't, at this point, we can't isolate them and do that testing to fulfill Koch's postulates.
Yeah, man, the treasure trove of information you get back is wild.
Right. I think that's the right term, a treasure trove, yeah. Because sometimes it gives you so much data. You have to figure out, you have to decide, well, what's the most important thing? And I think, that's where, the clinician and the diagnostician, they have to work very closely together because, again, you may see, a virus or bacteria in that flock. And the question is that what's causing the disease that we're seeing? Or is it just a random finding unrelated to what we're looking at? And it still requires, a really highly skilled clinician and diagnostician in the laboratory to help answer those questions. And some cases, further work is required to tease that out. But, that's one of the things that we're going to have to get through is that, again, that treasure trove of data, what is the most important thing here? Is that what's really causing the disease or not?
So then what are the barriers or limitations? I mean, part of it is just this enormous amount of data, but what are the things that are kind of stopping this from being routine?
So, diagnostics? Still, right. Why isn't it a more routine diagnostic? Cost is still an issue. So although the cost has come down quite a bit, we're still talking about in some cases, $250 plus per sample to get the results back. And in some cases that may, may pay itself off easily if you can find out a new pathogen or get a whole genome sequence back out that can help you decide what vaccine to use. But cost is still an issue. And I think over time, costs will decrease. But it's right now it's an incremental increase because it's still a complicated procedure to do because, again, you have to prepare the library, you have to run the sequence on the sequencer, and then you got to analyze all that data. So there's still a lot of steps involved. So it's still not turnkey. It's not something that everybody's going to just immediately be able to use or do in their laboratory. It's still requiring either on the research laboratory side or at the diagnostic laboratories, there's certainly some of the big laboratories are doing this type of work already. The other thing is lack of infrastructure. I'll throw that out there. Is again, not every veterinary diagnostic laboratory has this capability. And so having it accessible to more laboratories would certainly, or more poultry producers would I think, increase the uptake of this technology. Again, finding enough skilled clinicians and bioinformaticists that can work together to solve these issues, to understand what's important and what's not. I think that's also a key. And the last key is that what I've seen in the poultry industry, which I think is less of an issue with some of the other industries like the dairy or cattle or the swine industry, is that the poultry industry doesn't share data as readily as some of these other industries based on the diseases that they have circulating in their flocks. So they see it as proprietary information. And so they don't necessarily want to know for people to know exactly what farms have this disease or that disease. I'll give one small example that we were working in Georgia, looking with avian metapneumovirus after the virus had been introduced here. We got samples from the Georgia Poultry Laboratory Network, and we looked at them. We were able to pull out a lot of full genome sequences and actually help trace where the viruses might have come from. But as part of the agreement with working with them, we never knew what farm they came from. We didn't know when or where they were isolated. And so all the way we could say they were from Northeast Georgia or Southwest Georgia, they would give us that information, but they wouldn't give us the full information because they were concerned about releasing that information, how that might affect the poultry industry. So in that way, I think it's a bit, that people are reluctant to understand and do this testing because they might see or find something that they weren't expecting that might change, change their ability to trade or might change people's willingness to work with them. Those are issues that eventually need to be worked out, but that is an issue of being able to share that data and not have it have a negative effect again on your ability to trade or move product from one state or one country to another. So that's another issue that we have to overcome.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Adiseo provides nutritional solutions and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. At Signify Animal Lighting, we use light as a tool, backed by science to support growth, comfort, and performance. Better light, better animals. Better results with Signify. Barnwell Bio generates actionable health insights from your barn's microbiome. Visit barnwellbio.com. Evonik Animal Nutrition is committed to ensure food security and safety while reducing the ecological footprint of animal farming. Its products and services use evidence-based solutions that seek to promote animal welfare and reduce reliance on natural resources. All this is underpinned by long-standing industry partnerships and deep customer understanding. Evonik's focus on efficiency, sustainable, healthy nutrition, and collaborations with livestock farming partners creates value for customers and consumers.
So how do you see next-gen sequencing kind of shaping the future, the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years of the poultry industry?
So, yes. I think the molecular diagnostics in general are going to continue to play an increasing role in our ability to diagnose disease and to respond rapidly to these different disease outbreaks. I still see that real-time RT-PCR is going to be, a huge part of that puzzle for the next few years, or, probably for the next 10 years for sure, because that test is, it's been widely used. It's available. It's very sensitive. It's very specific. It's scalable. We can run, 10 samples, or we can run 1,000 samples in a single day if we needed to on these tests. So scalability is a really big key. And that's really what made real-time PCR take off, is that ability to scale up from a few samples to a lot of samples very quickly. The other thing, so I see that NGS, as it becomes easier to use, as it becomes less costly, and as people get more experience with how to interpret that data, and that they do get a comfort level that they're not going to have it negatively affect, their operations, I think they're going to start using it more and more. Again, getting it available in more diagnostic laboratories is going to be very important as well, because of course, just the accessibility. If it's not available, then you can't do it. But I think there's, as people see the value, there's going to be more labs that will want to run that. And then again, just that cost benefit analysis, those poultry producers, they have to make those decisions, about what is the data that we're getting back out? Is it worth the cost that we're paying for it?
Yeah.
I think long-term research-wise, understanding, again, I had mentioned that we have seen viruses that we, have been loosely associated with clinical disease, but we don't really understand how they fit in. I think in the long term, we will start doing studies where we combine all that information that the poultry industry has, looking at growth rates and clinical disease and production, and tie that back in that, well, we saw these viruses at this time, we saw a drop off in feed consumption, or we saw, some increase in diarrhea, that we can start correlating that those viruses with what the clinical disease might be there. Unless we can name it and be able to track it, it's hard to control it. That's kind of the first step. So that's kind of a research. Finding out, again, the combinations of pathogens. I'll go back to avian metapneumovirus as an example, that avian metapneumovirus can cause a very severe disease, but it generally doesn't cause it on its own. It has to be some secondary bacterial or viral infection before you start seeing severe clinical disease, including mortality of, 5-10% of the flock. But it's because you're getting secondary bacterial infections that, again, that avian metapneumovirus went through, lowered the immunity, allowed these other bacteria to come in, just like, we think about with any viral infection. And understanding what combinations of things, bacterial and viral pathogens together contribute to that, I think is another research goal that we want to continue to work on.
Yeah, that makes total sense. do you have any kind of resources or references that you might like to share with anyone listening who might want to go either dig further into the group, the work you've done or others have done, or just in general, next gen sequencing?
Sure. Certainly, I would like to target people to have people go look at the research papers that we published. Again, we're as part of the USDA, it's very important mm-hmm. to us to transfer this data to the public, and so we have a lot of that data. We had a paper by Dr. Paris from my laboratory a few years ago that talks about that depletion of the ribosomal RNA sequence that we've continue to use that I think is very valuable. We've been sharing that technology. We have, again, just small different improvements about changing a buffer that's a lot cheaper in our process. May save a few dollars per sample, but still gives the same results. And so we've published papers on that, and lots of applied papers, again, looking at how we've analyzed our sequences. Is that the best way? Maybe not necessarily, but that is one approach that you can look at. And again, people can certainly reach out to me directly if they have questions. The last part, as we think about the future, though, I think artificial intelligence is going to play a role, because the ability to handle large amounts of data and allow us to organize it in different ways, I think may be able to answer some of the questions. You have to be very careful with artificial intelligence, because it doesn't always give you correct answers, and so you always have to check to make sure that it does. But as I've started to use it more and more in my research, I've seen that it provides advantages, and as long as you have the right checks and balances, it does come together quite nicely.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me about the breadth of the work that you do, but also some of these future technologies. It's really exciting to talk to people who are kind of, in the trenches, understanding so people can adopt.
Well, again, thank you so much for inviting me on your show, and I appreciate the opportunity to share the research that I'm doing.
Oh, you're welcome. For those of you listening, please take a chance and like and follow our show, share the episode with other folks who might like to hear it. Thank you again for listening.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.